Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the second stream tonight. This is the 11th night, I believe. And my guest now is Frode Midjord, who is a favourite guest each year. People always love to hear from him, and they always ask if he's going to appear each year. Frode is the founder of the Skansa Forum, a conference organisation throughout in Europe, especially Scandinavia. And he's also the host of Guide to Culture, which is a cultural commentary channel on DLive. And is it still on YouTube as well?
Yeah, we do have a YouTube channel still, but I do the live streams on DLive. I might use the YouTube channel for something else in the future instead. I just thought it was more suitable for DLive at the moment, at least.
Yes. Okay, well, I've introduced you. Would you like to say something about yourself before we begin?
Yeah, I mean, well, thank you, first of all, and Merry Christmas. Scandinavians celebrate Christmas on Christmas Eve on the 24th, so this is the big day in Scandinavia.
Merry Christmas and good Yule to you.
Yeah, good Yule. Exactly. So there's I think there's a separation of a few countries in Europe celebrate on the 24th. They open Christmas presents on the evening of the 24th, and I think the UK and America and some other countries, especially Catholic countries in on the continent, celebrate more on the 25th. So I guess that's the deal. But yeah, because you asked me last year, or we talked last year, which day I should appear. And you said most people are, of course, they're busy on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. So I said, well, I'll be happy to do it then. And so it's sort of it's becoming a tradition.
Yeah, I'd actually forgotten. Let me see. What did you appear on Christmas Eve last year? Oh, yes, you did. Right. Okay. I'd forgotten that. Well, yeah, I guess that is a tradition then from now on.
Yeah, I said other people have a life, so they have other things to do.
Yeah, it's funny the way this takes shape. But yeah, I know what you mean, and it is difficult. I mean, other people as well in the movement. The 24th is usually the most difficult night to fill because there are, you know, it's everyone. Certainly in America and Britain, the people are getting that they're preparing for Christmas, basically. Okay, so we'll probably talk about quite a variety of things. And so the best way in seems just to ask you my default question this year, which is, hasn't this been a hell of a year, 2020? Frode, how would you react to that? What a year this has been.
It has. It's been a challenge, I think, for people in many ways. I mean, it's three big obvious things. It's the American election. It's the BLM riots in reaction to the first of all, the jogger, and then George Floyd, and then the BLM riots. It's like a three-step thing, and then of course the whole COVID situation. And it's been a lot of stuff with COVID. I think that in the beginning, I talked about this and I said, yeah, if you see a virus coming out of China and you see images of the Chinese government locking down areas of the country, and we basically know that this virus came out of a lab, to the best of our knowledge, it came out of a lab. We don't know why. I mean, labs do research, they experiment with viruses to create medicines, vaccines. It could be any reason, but it's risky, right? So we don't know what this is. So it would be prudent to take some measures, some precautions in the beginning until we have a knowledge of what this is. So I said early on, I said two things. I said, first of all, that I think it is rational to do some things in the beginning, so it buys us time, right? Until we know what this is, because a lot of people were just dismissing it immediately, automatically, a sort of knee-jerk reaction, and that is sort of like you know, crying that the wolf is coming. You know, if you're always dismissing everything as a false flag or a conspiracy, you end up lacking credibility, and no one can take you seriously. So you have to take things on a sort of a case to case basis. And we didn't know. I mean, people who said initially that this is not a harmful virus, they were just guessing. Because the fact of the matter is, we didn't know back then. Because the thing is, what we had numbers of confirmed cases and we had numbers of deaths. Those always misrepresent reality because not every case gets registered. So we don't know how many cases there are that aren't registered. To find out the real numbers or get real statistics, you have to take statistical samples out of the population. We hadn't done that back then. Now we have done that, and now we know the real numbers. And what we can conclude is that the lockdowns and all these precautions continue, but we know that the virus isn't dangerous enough to motivate those extreme reactions. I think that is very obvious. And I also said, the second thing I said initially is that if we go into a lockdown, if we start doing these things, even if it's initially motivated, it's justified initially, the elites, there's a huge risk that the elites will take advantage of it because they like power. I mean, this is just...
Yeah, they're not going to let a good crisis go to waste.
Exactly. I mean, I like to compare it with 9/11, for example. So, if people my age and older definitely will remember how it was, how air travel was before 9/11 in the 90s. You didn't have this rule that you couldn't bring liquids on board a plane. Maybe the younger kids don't remember that, but we didn't have these extreme rules and extreme security controls at the airports.
Flying now is an awful experience, and I absolutely hate it. Mm-hmm. And not just because of the stress that, you know, have I forgotten anything and all that kind of thing, but also just the experience in the airport of the scanning and so on. I know it could be a lot worse than it is. I know it's not like you know, the Gestapo interviewing you or something. I know it's not that bad, but it's still dehumanizing, and it just feels like, so this is the start of our holiday, of our vacation. This is the start of us having fun.
Yeah,
you know, and it's horrible.
It is.
But yeah, you say that you can remember what it was like before. I actually can't, and I actually did go on a flight March or April 2001, I flew from Edinburgh to Amsterdam. It was my first time in Amsterdam. And I honestly can't remember how it... I just know that after 9/11, it all changed.
Yeah. I actually flew to America like a month after 9/11 happened. We went on vacation. Well, no, we didn't go to the United States. We went to Canada, but still, it's close enough for it to be like, okay, this is something. You could still feel it at the airports. The point is that, yeah, I did fly a lot when I was a kid, and also, you know, growing up, because I have family in different countries. So I just visiting family. That's why. But the point is that, yeah. So on 9/11, this terror attack happened, and basically we have emergency security precautions. We do things, it's basically a state of emergency, and we have to be extra cautious, and we have to amp up security. But the point is that it's now 20 years ago, and we're still in a state of emergency? My point is that it seems like, well, it doesn't just seem like, the elites love power. They love control. And this is not some sort of weird conspiracy theory. It's just human nature that power, in a sense, is addictive, and they want to be in control. And they think they're narcissists as well, of course. So they think that they know best. So if they have the power, they will know what to do. So my point is that they know when to grab power and grab extra power, but they don't know when to give it back, right? Because just security at airports has now become a permanent thing. It's not just a temporary thing after that terror attack. You know, we've been going for 20 years. My fear is that this is going to be the same. Already in the initial stages of this pandemic, or call it what you will, this situation, a lot of powerful people in the sort of, let's say, Bill Gates type people were talking about that, well, we might never go back to normal, you know? We might never go back to how things were before.
Some of them have explicitly said that we will never go back to normal. What do you think about why do you have any thoughts on why somebody like Bill Gates, who, let's remember, and I don't want to be sarcastic, I know that people can change careers and that someone at a high level of in one field could be competent at a high level in another field. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it is rather a jump to go from a salesman, a computer, Windows operating system salesman, to suddenly this savior of billions of people. That's a strange jump to make. And what do you think about, do you have any thoughts on why someone like Bill Gates would thrust himself into the center of this pandemic now?
I do. I think that people who are extremely successful in business life, for example, they have a certain personality type, right? And so they are motivated to creating a very successful business, making a lot of money. But at a certain point, you don't need more money, and you have achieved all the success you need. Bill Gates isn't the richest man in the world right now, but at a point, you know, in years past, he was considered the richest man in the world, and he doesn't need more money. At that point, you don't need money to spend money. You just want more money so that you can influence the world in a way that you want it to be.
Exactly. It's got to the point where you literally couldn't spend all of Bill Gates's money. Mm-hmm. He's got so much that not even an ordinary person, even someone who enjoyed spending ridiculous amounts of money on island vacations and fleets of limousines and so on, you couldn't even spend his fortune with that, being that flagrant. So it gets to the point where it's not about the money anymore. This is something that I think we really need to wrangle with. And for a lot of people, this will be difficult because we can't conceive of being in that position where money does not matter anymore. And as you say, at that point, it becomes more about influencing the world rather than accruing wealth to spend on yourself or your loved ones, or your family. It's now, okay, how can I actually change the world at large?
Yeah. So at a certain point, money stops being money and money just becomes power. And the thing is that at that point, you want to, it's sort of like an art project or whatever. You have an image of what you want to create with the world and you spend your money doing it. It's the same thing with George Soros. Why does he, they call these people philanthropists, which is sort of, I guess they give money to political causes, but not everyone agrees that those are good causes. You know, you can also call them megalomaniacs. The thing is that, yeah, they have a vision of how they want the world to be, and they are going to spend their wealth to push things in that direction. I'll give you a sort of an unsavory example from the Middle Ages. There was in occultism, a very famous man in the past was Gilles de Rais in France in the Middle Ages. He was a nobleman. I don't remember his exact rank, but and he was very good looking. He was very charming. He could get any women that he wanted. And he had all the wealth that he needed, right? So, I mean, many people think that, oh, you want to get a beautiful woman, you want to make money. Well, if you have all of that, then what? Well, if you have like a strong, like will to power, then what? Well, what he did is he started with occultism. He started with like occult rituals. He started raping women. He started doing occult rituals with murdering children. And I'm not saying that Bill Gates is like that, but I'm just saying that if you have all those basic things you need, and if you still have a powerful force driving you forward, you will find another outlet for that force. And you know, it takes different forms. But the point is that very wealthy people, they will have political visions, and they will try to impact the world or push the world in that direction. And that is literally why we have things like the World Economic Forum. And I think that is because where people like that meet. And they have a certain a vision, an ideology, and they talk about how to make a reality out of that ideology, how to influence the world to push it in this direction that they want to see it go. I mean, that's literally it.
And how would you describe that ideology that they have and the vision of the world that they have?
Well. I think that's an important question. I think that the important thing with a group like the World Economic Forum that meets in Davos is that you have, so in a modern society, you have basically three branches of power, right? You have mass media, big media, you have big industry, big finance, which includes, you know, mega corporations like Google, etc. And you have the political elite, the managerial state with a huge bureaucracy, etc. You have the elites of those three branches of power meeting up and talking about what they want to do with the world. The thing you have to understand is that I don't think we should see them as malicious, because that will sort of blur our vision, because they think that they are doing good, right? But there are even psychological studies of this, that most violence and most terror and most most violence, offensive violence, is used when people think that they are doing good, right? Yes. It's not that they're thinking, now we're going to do evil stuff. It's because they think that, no, we're going to save the world. They're fanatics.
Yes.
They're like Puritan fanatics in times past, or Europe went through basically a genocidal war over two different interpretations of Christianity, right? The 30-year war and the wars, well, several wars between Catholics and Protestants. It's because they thought that they had the right interpretation. And when you have that and you become a fanatic, it's the same thing with communism. They want to create a world in their image, in the image in their head. That's how they want to create a world. And so if you just look at how these people live, I think you can reach certain conclusions about their worldview. I mean, these are people who have a lot of money. They live in safe neighborhoods. They travel a lot. And the thing is that it's a cliche by now, but when people in the top elite of the world, when they have met someone from a different race or from a different nation, a different culture, well, they've met some wealthy Indian or Arab at Oxford or something like that, right? I mean, the thing is, that is their image of, well, I got along with him, so what? Why can't we have just a mixed world because I got along with this extreme exception to the rule, right? But the thing is that isn't representative of the world in general.
I think it's also worth saying, in just for the sake of understanding these people, that it is actually an enjoyable experience to speak to someone from a very different background, different race and so on, and yet find commonality with them. This is something that people have talked about for a very long time. So it's something that it's like we've overcome that barrier, that gap between us. So I can understand some wealthy person at Oxford they've come from a very white background, very monocultural, very perhaps very boring. And here they are, and there's a black person in front of them who's exotic, although they would never use that word, exotic, unusual, and intelligent. And he's come from a very different background. And yet they can converse, and they can talk about literature and high culture together, and, and whatever it is, and money and travel and so on. And I can understand people getting excited by that experience and thinking, so this is multiculturalism. This is this is equality. This is diversity. This is the experience that is possible now in this era of, you know, easy travel and so on. So while I want everyone to have this experience, I want everyone to meet a charming but exotic foreign person and build bridges with them. That this is a wonderful experience. But of course, the reality, as you were about to say, is quite different.
It is. That's the thing. I mean, these people are extreme exceptions. You find the odd, you know, person from India or person from the Middle East somewhere who studied at Oxford, has an education, a lot of money, and you know, is in the, can live in the wealthy neighborhoods, but they don't really represent the people coming here, and they don't represent the sort of cultural clashes and ethnic clashes that happen in Europe. So I think that is a major reason. I mean, people have selective perception, right? That is a major reason why they think that we should just be fine with what's going on, because they're fine with it. In their life, yes, it doesn't matter.
Yes, in their life, it's a genuine pleasure to meet one new person after another and find common ground with them, because it's not a ghetto. It's not a scramble for resources. It's civilized.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's enjoyable. It's charming. It's witty. It's cultured, and so on. So I think they do believe, well, this is what it is to meet other cultures and to meet other people and so on. But the reality on the ground, well, first of all, it's not high culture. It's not wealthy. And second, the numbers change everything, as we know. You know, it's not some, you know, the experience of a poor white person in a deprived part of London meeting a black person. It's not that they discuss Shakespeare that they both read at their prep school. It's, it's that it's like the black person has 1,000 other poor black people backing him up, and they're not into Shakespeare or Chaucer or anything else. So it's a completely, radically different experience that actually represents the reality of multiculturalism.
Yeah, and the second thing is that it's not about individuals. I mean, it's always been the case that an individual can move from one country to another, and he'll maybe experience a bit of trouble, you know, fitting in, but eventually he can usually assimilate. But there are two factors, right? It's numbers and it's proximity. If someone is going to move from Scotland to Sweden, he's going to have an easier time than if one person moving from Somalia to Sweden. But with 100,000 people moving in, then it's not an individual and you can't assimilate. And then it's certainly a people. It's an ethnic group that's moving in. And that has always in history created conflicts. Even in America, it's a huge deal. It was a huge deal when Catholics from Ireland or from Italy moved to America, because they became an ethnic minority. And it created a lot of, I mean, an overwhelming part of them became communists, etc., in opposition to the
it's the same in
elite.
It's even the same in Scotland, you know. Yeah. And I was talking about this with one of my previous guests. I can't remember who it was now, but who was it? I wish I could remember who it was. But anyway, it came up that the Catholic versus Protestant thing, and that it's a thing even in Scotland, where there's this long rise going for centuries. I think it was Count Dankula. It came up in that one, strangely enough. It's a thing even there. And it's a conflict that burns and burns onwards. You know, it's and that's not even racial. It's ethnic. in the sense that it's Irish Catholics and Scottish Protestants, but there's really not much difference there in terms of genetics course. Or whatever. So that's a religious one, but yes, ethnic, because it's tied to a group. So sorry to interrupt you.
No, I mean, my point is just that, yeah, you can assimilate an individual. And when you, that is why this whole objection that you'll hear from high-minded people that, well, I get along with people from all races. Well, I do too. But I'm not so stupid that I think that it's about me. A society isn't about what I do. A society is what millions of people do together, right? And in that case, groups and ethnic belonging matters a lot. It's not about who I get along. I get along with people from all races. I don't start fighting with people because they belong to. I don't care. But I that just understand from history and from
experience. Yeah. I've got to say, that's the most ridiculous mental image of you, like, seeing a black man and just having to beat him up, just feeling this mad compulsion. That is utterly ridiculous. To interject there.
Yeah, I mean, it's the point. It's not about me, and it's not about who I personally get along with or my particular needs. No, it's about looking at huge masses of people. How we can look at this empirically, how do they get along? Well, look at the Balkans, look at Yugoslavia. There's a word called Balkanization, neighboring countries fighting, killing each other because small differences between them, cultural differences, were enough to cause war. I mean, that's the history of Europe. So you think that you can just move in hundreds of thousands of people from other continents and think that it's just going to work fine because, your identity is just written on a piece of paper. It's just a language or something. No, it's not. These are the things that, you know, misconceptions in our worldview, and the people in who have a lot of money, they are not exceptional. You had a previous guest on, the guy who was in the UKIP party. I forget his name, but he said
Godfrey Bloom.
Yeah, he said something that I've often said as well, that when you actually meet, he said that he has interacted with a lot of influential people. He works in, you know, the EU, etc. And they're not very impressive. I mean, you can't just say that they have a greater understanding and therefore they have this huge plan. No, they are motivated by the same fundamental worldview as your sort of, I like to call them Puritan, your Puritan leftist, right? Because they like to preach and they have the same sense of right and wrong. They have the same mental map of what makes a person good and what makes a person evil. And in our culture, for a long time, we have had the fundamental principles of individualism and universalism. And if you can, you get, Kevin MacDonald has written a lot about this, about how these people, it's sort of like a junkie getting a fix from virtue signaling, right? It's addictive behavior. And if they can get themselves to think or say things that are politically correct or that are aligned with this worldview of ours, they get a high from it. And that's why they do it. I mean, they don't have, rich people, influential people, don't have another mental image than your average ridiculous person that you studied with at the university. They have the same mental map.
Yes, they're not a different species. I think some people probably find it, and I don't think a lot of people would want to admit to this, but I think a lot of people perhaps have the idea that rich people are more intelligent than the average, like much more intelligent than the average, and more cultured than, and in a certain sense, well, what would you say about that?
Well, I think that if you would take the average at Davos compared to the average of a random city in Europe, I think you'll find that they have a higher average. But I don't think that they are exceptional. I think that if you took an average of your guests on Millennial or whatever, they'll also have a much higher than average. I mean, the thing is that people who are interested in anything are often smarter. I mean, people who just spend their lives not thinking about anything, they just get home from work and they watch their, you know, soccer game or you know, football game or TV show or whatever, and they don't really care about anything, yeah, I think they have probably a lower IQ. So, I mean, that doesn't make them bad, but it's just a fact of life. And I think that, yeah, very rich people probably have a higher than average, but I don't think that they are necessarily exceptional. And more importantly, they don't have a better understanding of the world. I think that IQ is somewhat overrated. I think that there are a lot of, as we call, clever sillies, which is a term invented by a doctor a couple of decades ago, because he was writing about all these stupid people at the universities creating one weird, stupid theory after another, because that's how they make money. You know, if you work in sociology,
it's also how they impress themselves.
Yeah, and impress their colleagues. Because
Yeah.
I mean, you can come up with some batshit crazy postmodern theory, but because it takes a bit of mental power to dig through those texts, people are impressed by them. And that's how they impress each other, although it doesn't really say much. But yeah, so you have a lot of stupid, intelligent people, clever sillies. I mean, that's how a lot of people make money, especially in the humanities and in social sciences. I studied a lot of philosophy, and especially in postmodernism, you know, when you take the time to read through a lot of the stuff that they've written, it's like, yeah, you have to read it a few times and it takes a lot of thinking. But then when you get to the end of it, there's really no reward, because it's just, they just wrote a lot of malarkey just to impress each other. I'm not saying everything is like that, but there's a lot of stuff in academia that is like that, definitely. So, I mean, intelligence, high IQ isn't automatically, doesn't automatically give you a very reasonable and sensible sort of view of the world.
Yeah, I think you'd be looking at a combination of to have an ideal observer, it would be someone who was intelligent, but also someone who was sensible,
yeah,
but also someone who was acutely aware of their own capacity for bias,
yeah,
and yeah, so that's a rare combination.
Yeah, and you know how we all know that the left can't meme, right? And one of the reasons is that when, you know, it's there's this meme about leftists. When they try to meme, they have to write a wall of text, right? It's in order to explain their shit that doesn't make sense.
Yes.
And it's the same thing with all their theories. All their theories, everything they're doing is basically just coming up with explanation to why it looks like they're wrong about everything, but they're actually not wrong. That's why they write these heavy, thick books, because everyone can see that the left, let's call them the left, the cultural Marxists, whatever, they're wrong about everything. But they have to explain why they're right. No, you misunderstood. And that's why they have to write all these long books. That takes some brain power. They're still wrong, but they've impressed some impressionable people, you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. It's. I mean, I noticed. I was saying this the other night in another stream with about the Communist Manifesto, and I read that, and I still see it with other, like, there's a forum that I sometimes go to, and there's a guy on there who is a communist, and his posts are, it's like an old style forum, bulletin board thing, and his posts are always big paragraphs, like at least five or six solid lines, and then another one the same, and another one the same, and it's a style of writing that I associate with communists and far leftists because of, you know, reading the Communist Manifesto, where it's an extremely boring leaden prose, and it's just awful. But of course they need it, because so much of what they're saying is just fundamentally and obviously untrue. You would never just observe people and then think this stuff that's in these communist texts. You have to think yourself into it. Yeah. It's like a sort of weird voodoo.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I've used the example. I'm not going to go into it, because I know, you know, the rules and everything with streaming. But group differences in IQ, for example, right? Every test, every single, without exception, every single empirical test says that there are group differences. Yet the majority of the researchers think that they don't exist. So basically, their research is about explaining why the tests don't show what they should show according to their theory. And in empirical science, you have to go with the test results. You can't just say, well, no, my theory says that the test, the empirical, well, then you're not doing empirical science anymore. Then you're doing astrology, right?
And this is why you've got to combine being intelligent with also being sensible. And I've seen people say, well, I've got a degree in biology, and I'm telling you that there is no biological basis for race.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. and I hope you enjoy your degree in biology, because you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
It's just anyone can see. And the very, I mean, we don't need to go into it now. It's kind of 2016 territory. But anyone can see that they have different ways of discrediting the concept of race. And the main one is, well, where's the boundary? Where does a white person become a black person? You can't tell me exactly where white ends and black begins. Mm. Therefore, European ends and African begins. Therefore, these categories are simply fictions. But by that rationale, every category is a fiction, because almost nothing has absolute beginnings and endings. Everything is a gradient. So to say that means there's no basis for race is utterly ridiculous. And as you say, these are people who, they go to university to get trained in this, mm-hmm. and they're intelligent enough to pass the tests, but they don't realize that what they're being trained with is drivel. It's obvious. It must be drivel, because there are black people and there are white people, and you see them in the world.
The existence of edge cases doesn't prove anything. Just because gray exists, that doesn't mean that white doesn't exist and black doesn't exist. And you can say the same thing about rich and poor. I mean, these are categories that have been used prominently in politics for decades and centuries. So exactly how many dollars or euros are you allowed to earn to be rich or poor? Well, there are people who, let's say that I earn 2,000 euro per month. That means I can pay my rent and I can get food on the table. So I'm not poor. Does that mean I'm extremely wealthy? No, there are degrees here. And just because you can't say exactly on which cent and on which dollar someone goes from rich to poor, because it's a gradual thing, that doesn't mean that rich people don't exist and poor people don't exist. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And everyone knows it, but they are being dishonest when it comes to things like race. Because, of course, if you have billions of people living on the globe and they live on different continents, of course that in the area, in the Middle East, for example, where Africa meets Europe, of course there are going to be mixed cases who are going to be edge cases. That doesn't mean that you can't see a difference between a Dane and a Congolese. There are clear examples and there are less clear examples. Deal with it.
And we could go through all of these ridiculous arguments that are used. Another one would be that there is no gene for European. There's no single gene that makes you European. Therefore, there is no such thing as European. I've actually heard that. It's so cretinous. You can't believe that somebody would at a university with a degree would believe it, but they do. I mean, it's actually a collection of genes that constitute European and a collection of genes that constitute Chinese or whatever it is. There doesn't need to be a single gene. And another one would be that there's more genetic diversity within a race than between races. Irrelevant. It doesn't matter, because the genes are inconsequential ones within a race.
It's simply a logical fallacy.
It's Lewontin's
fallacy. Basically, it's the same thing as saying that because there is a greater difference in height among women than the average between men and women, therefore there is no difference between men and women. Yes, you can find the tallest woman in the world. There's a bigger difference between the tallest woman in the world and the shortest woman in the world. That difference is bigger than the average difference between men and women. That's true, but that doesn't mean that the average difference doesn't exist, because if it doesn't exist, then you have nothing to compare to. You say in the example, in the presupposition, that there is an average difference in height between men and women. I mean,
yes,
a completely ridiculous argument.
That's a good point. You know, you can only say that there's more diversity within a race
if there is a diversity in the first place.
If there is a race to measure that diversity within, that's a good point. I hadn't actually thought of that.
Basically, I wrote there's a speech that I want to give about this this sort of social constructivism of race. I actually wrote that speech back in 2006 when I started looking into these things and I first sort of started looking seriously at social constructivism, and I haven't been able, and I haven't had like a good opportunity to give that speech. I was going to do it in Zagreb, in connection to the big debate between Jared and Jones, but of course we were prevented. I actually gave the speech once in Stockholm in Swedish, though, so it's not available in English in back in 2018. But yeah, I've actually, you know, I have something, I have a whole thing prepared about that. So I hope that I'll have a good opportunity.
There was a period in 2018 or 19 when you seemed to be going to conferences all the time. I was amazed at how many things you were doing at one point. I was jealous, I'll be honest with you. I was thinking, God, I'd like to be doing that. It was very impressive.
Yeah, I don't know. I just didn't think that, you know, I had the right, you know, the right audience or whatever to talk about this. But when we were going to talk about race and, you know, does race exist, et cetera. So I thought, okay, this is a golden opportunity because, you know, here we have people who are thinking about this issue and people who will sort of appreciate the arguments, you know, stroking my ego a bit, you know. No, but I mean, I just thought that I had a good, that was a good opportunity for that particular speech.
Well, yes, there's a Greb thing. I was going to leave that to the end because people have been asking, actually throughout Millennial, people now and then have been saying, what about EMJ versus Jared Taylor? When's it going to happen? So yeah, you can maybe address that towards the end. Sure. So let's return to the topics. We were talking about the elites and what their ideology is and what their worldview is. So we've talked about that they like diversity and all that, but I think there's more to it than that. So let's explore that a bit more. And what if you were to describe what you think, I mean, obviously you don't know for sure, but if you were to surmise, what do you think is the world that they are trying to build? And of course, from there, we can go on to the Great Reset and so on.
Well, I think it's liberalism. I think liberalism has been the ideology for a long time in the West. I think it's sort of, you know, it's becoming more and more crystallized and becoming clearer and clearer to everyone. I think a lot of these things happening now, Nietzsche wrote a lot of stuff criticizing liberals or the ideology that has now become sort of liberalism. He saw a lot of trends before they happened, let's say that. He wrote in the 1800s, right? So in the past century, a lot of things, that's why he's still relevant today, 150 years later, because he wrote about a lot of these things. I think liberalism is what has caused this disaster on many levels. I'll just give you three examples of how that has happened. Liberalism is the idea of the lesser and lesser relevance of states. We have to have open. We're individuals, right? So we have to let people travel and between nations. And just this idea of globalism, of more and more globalism, prevented our elites, our political elites, from doing the one sensible thing, which was closing the borders at an early stage. If they closed the border to China at an early stage, which many people urged them to do, they could have prevented this whole thing from happening. Yeah, did you want to say something about that?
Sorry, yeah, this is the point that Greg made in his stream a few days ago, that it was globalism which prevented them from doing the obvious thing, just close the borders now, and no one was doing it. And they never did it throughout the entire throughout this entire year, until now, actually, oddly enough, when Britain has suddenly been isolated just in time for the Brexit deal, which is quite funny.
Yeah.
it's suddenly been isolated. All these flights are just banned, and the Eurotunnel has been closed. I don't know if that's the first time ever that that's happened, but there's mm-hmm. just no, as far as I know, there's no traffic between Britain and Europe and the continent of Europe right now. But I think this is the first time this has happened throughout the entire COVID thing. That they've closed the borders, and it's because we've got this new version, the son of coronavirus, so bigger and worse and more terrifying than ever before.
Yeah. Who would have thought that the viruses would mutate? I mean, that's a completely novel thing. But yeah, definitely, globalism is a part of the liberal utopia. We can't just stop. People from traveling. So that's the first step. The second step is also, shall we call it universalism or individualism? Universalism and individualism are just two sides of the same coin. And the point is that we now know who is vulnerable to this virus. Essentially, everyone who dies is old or has some pre-existing condition. But because we have this society where we can't sort of group people and talk about who is vulnerable to what, we have to treat everyone the same. So we have to lock everyone up, even people who are not vulnerable to this, even people who are young and they would have a flu-like kind of experience if they got the virus, but they would be fine. We know this because hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people have had the virus. So we know what it looks like. But no, we just have to treat everyone the same. And that's why we have to close down all of society. That is the ideology. We can't just isolate the people who are actually vulnerable. No, that would be sort of discrimination. So
do you think that the reason for that is ideological, or do you not think it's that they want to close down the whole of society?
Well, I think there's a bit of both, but I think if you imagine what's in the realm of possibilities in public discourse, they would be far less comfortable saying, "Okay, we have to close, we have to shut down everything for these and these people." No, because the same has to go for everyone, because our worldview is based on equality. Everyone has to be treated equal. I think that is a huge imperative. I think that is why they won't even contemplate doing different things for different people, because that would violate the sacred principle of equality.
Yes, it would be age profiling, like racial profiling, which we know is a dreadful thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so that's one thing. I mean, so we have globalism, and we have the principle of equality. That's the second one, and the third one is this thing with the vaccine, which is this faith, this superstitious worship of technological progress. We're not going to deal with a virus in a normal way as we've always done. No. We're gonna invent something that's going to save the world. I think people are impressed by bullshit like that. We're gonna invent some technological. We're gonna invent a new type of virus that's going to deal with the situation, and everyone has to take it. I mean, there are different things motivating different people, but that's how it fits into the narrative. Is my point. That's how it fits in, because we have a hubris. We think that liberalism is sort of a hubristic mindset. We think that nothing bad can really happen to us because we have this idea of invincible progress. It's sort of why Sweden thinks that they can nothing bad can happen. They can just fuck up their country no matter how much. They will always be fine because, you know, nothing can harm us. It's sort of hubris.
Yes, they've come up with an ideal for living, a social paradigm that is almost utopian. It's almost perfect.
Yeah. But I just think that it's this superstitious worship of technological progress that has a lot of people believing in the magical powers of a vaccine. And thinking that we just have to take the plunge, we just have to take this leap of faith into this new vaccine, although it hasn't gone through the same normal process as every other vaccine. I mean, And that's another thing. That's about the dishonesty of this whole thing, that they will call people, they'll be science deniers, or they'll be anti-vax. Well, maybe you're not a science denier. Maybe you have looked at the science and made a cost-benefit analysis of the situation and looked at, well, the virus isn't all this dangerous. Why would I take a vaccine that we don't know the long-term consequences of? It's simply a rational decision. It's a decision. It's not because you deny the effectiveness of vaccines in general, or that you deny. No, it's simply, it's a personal decision. I mean, some people think it's worth it. Some people don't. Deal with it, you know? It's just the dishonesty of the situation that pisses me off.
The dishonesty is incredible, and you see it in every aspect of the COVID story. And with the vaccine, I mean, there's just so much that we could say about that, but I don't know what is safe to say on YouTube. Nobody does. But I think that the fact that the virus has and I've said this before, I'm just going to say it one more time, the fact that the virus has a 99.6% survival rate, I think I don't understand why you would want a vaccine, or why you would think you need to vaccinate billions of people, entire populations, entire nations, for a vaccine that will only kill 0.4% of the people who get it.
There's a lot of dishonesty. The same thing. They say that we need this because the hospitals are sort of overburdened. They can't handle all the people. I've been to the hospital. I was the only person there. I mean, but that's just one case.
I've heard it from other people in various numerous countries that they've gone to a hospital and it's been deserted. Nothing's going on. There aren't even nurses doing TikTok routines. It's not even that is happening. No. They're dead zones. Mm-hmm. So this idea that they're just overwhelmed is apparently just complete rubbish.
It's not true. Yeah, I mean, at least in my experience, I mean, it might be in different countries, but I've talked to a lot of people. This has been going on for a year, so a lot of people have had to go to the hospital for different reasons. And I've never heard anyone say that, oh, it's very crowded. No, it's less crowded than in a normal year.
it's amazing, but it's really incredible. And this obvious point to make here, but it really goes to show how effective the mainstream media is at maintaining a lie, telling a lie and then getting people to go along with it, getting people to believe it in some sense. Really remarkable. We're looking at manufactured lies, manufactured untruth, and in numerous different ways. Numerous lies are being told all at the same time about COVID, and one of them is that and it should be quite easy to diffuse this lie, but it's not, the lie that the hospitals are overwhelmed, when we can see that they're not. This is incredible. You know, there should be. I don't know what to say about that. It's just incredible.
It is. I mean, it's so. Yeah, I think there's, but yeah, I think that the ideology, the narrative, is just the same old liberal narrative of the liberal worldview, the worldview according to individualism and liberalism, and these sort of sacred principles of progress and equality and all these things, and sort of global travel, the sort of irrelevance of nations. I think all these. This worldview, this mental map or mental image of how the world works, has led to a lot of stupid decisions. And then added to that, I think it's the addictive effect of power. Like I said, it's sort of like, you know, in ancient Rome, when they had when someone in a state of emergency, someone could assume the power of dictator, but like Sulla. But he had to know when to give it back, right? In order to be a good leader, a good politician, you had to know, okay, now the state of emergency is passed. Now I give this special power back. But leaders don't have that ability because
they don't have honor.
Yeah, they don't have honor, and we have this other kind of managerial state where no one is responsible for anything, so that they just want more and more power. And when they have gotten this sort of extraordinary power like they have now, when they can control everyone in a greater detail than ever before in human history. And I think they're going to be very reluctant to give it back. And I don't think that's a conspiracy of any sort. I just think that is the nature of the beast. That is how our power structure works in this current society.
Yeah. I should say that just to remind people about the questions, you can post them on Entropy. I will also, I've got someone now monitoring the DLive chat for diamond donations, or I can't remember what the terminology is. I should also say that somebody just donated a Ninja Genie. And I'm not familiar with the whole DLive stuff, but I believe that is my first ever Ninja Genie. So thank you very much to Lemons Bear for that. All right. So, yeah, and there's Entropy as well. So thank you very much. Okay, so I'm not sure what to move on to now, but I think that there is... Oh, yeah, so we haven't gotten to the Great Reset. I mean, that some people seem to think that it's not going to go anywhere. That this, you know, Klaus Schwab and the WEF, the World Economic Forum and all that, and Bill Gates, that it will just... that this is just going to resolve. People will take the vaccine and then things will go back to normal. And the utopians like Klaus Schwab won't get what they want. They tried it in 2009 with the swine flu thing, didn't work then. And it's not going to work this time either. I'm not optimistic about that at all. I think that this is it's a very different situation from 2009 with swine flu. I mean, this is huge. What COVID has been made something massive compared to the swine flu epidemic or whatever pandemic of 2009. I think that the globalists like Schwab are much more entrenched. They're much more connected than they were back then. I think that their ability to spread a message, to transmit an instruction, all of this is far more efficient now and effective now than it was then. So I don't think that this is just going to blow over and that we're going to return to normality. And as you said, they don't want to return to normality, and they've explicitly said that we're not going to return to the old normal of, you know, February 2020. That's the past now. That's history. That's the, I don't know what it might be called. It might be called the post-democrat or the late stage democracy. I don't know what they would call it, but definitely it's not something that it's something that they want to be the past. They want that to be historical now. So that's what I think. I think you agree.
Yeah, I think I agree in many, many respects. And I think it's important to compare these things with, you know, a first attempt to create a huge panic and it doesn't work. It sort of fades out. And then a second attempt. It's the same thing that happened with the BLM riots. They made a first very sincere attempt with the jogger who was shot. It sort of didn't work. And then they created a second attempt with George Floyd.
George Floyd.
And the thing about both those cases is that they are irrelevant cases. I mean, they are irrelevant happenings in a local. So a drug addict like George Floyd, if he dies in police custody, that should be perhaps a minor news item in the local papers in Minneapolis, where he was. It shouldn't be national news. And it should definitely not be international news that a random people die every day in America for different reasons. It shouldn't be news on the Faroe Islands and in Scotland and in Sweden and in Norway and for several days in a row that this completely unimportant person who was a drug addict died in police custody. It's a non-event in international news. It's so unimportant. But yeah, the mass media created this thing. I mean, that's the first thing people should ask themselves. Why was this on the news on the other side of the planet? It's a completely irrelevant happening.
Well, what the answer to that is that for years before this, they had built up the concept, the notion of that the American police are racist and murderous towards black people, especially black men, and that in turn is a symptom of systemic racism among white people, which in turn is a legacy of slavery and the empires, colonialism and so on. So it's not just what it's like. George Floyd represents all of the oppression of the white man over the black man, going back centuries, and represents the ongoing and current problem of whiteness here and now, which is basically that we're racist towards black people. So it's not just that, he was just one man, and he was not the most impressive or likable or admirable man.
Someone made a t-shirt that said that George Floyd is the greatest black man who ever lived.
But no comment. But the idea is not that he was in himself a great guy, impressive, whatever. The idea is that he represents the victimhood, the eternal victimhood of black people at the hands of white people. And so that is why it exploded as a news story all over the world, because it's this dreadful thing about us that we've got to address. I mean, it was just a weapon to use.
Of course, I mean, that's the narrative they want to create. But I mean, if you just look at it, if you're, my point is that if you are a quote unquote normie, if you're looking at this from the outside, the first thing you could tell those people is, well, ask yourself, why is this a thing in the media? It's obviously because they want to create something, because they want to create a narrative, and because they want to create events like Black Lives. Why were there Black Lives Matter protests or riots in England and in Sweden? Why? Because of this guy who died in police custody in Minneapolis.
But again, it relies on the narrative. It's not really about him dying in police custody.
No, exactly. I mean, it represents. Of course. I mean, that's my point. I mean, that's what you would have to ask these people. That, well, you have to ask yourself, why is this? So I mean, that's the dishonesty. But with the Great Reset, let's go back to the Great Reset, because that's also, like you said, the swine flu was also an attempt to sort of create a mass hysteria, scare people, and it didn't work. Now I'm not sure it has worked, but because basically everyone I've talked to thinks that it's exaggerated, but they have at least implemented official policies, to the effect that they want. When it comes to the Great Reset, we can always just speculate about what's going to happen in the future and how much of this they're going to implement, but they're going to implement more than zero of it. I mean, it's going to be more Great Reset in 2021 or 2025 than in 2019. I mean, they don't have to implement everything for it to be an actually relevant thing. So that's one thing. I mean, yeah, they have these plans. The other thing, the most important thing, I think, about the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum is that it is a perfect example that's out in the open that you can point to and say that here are elites who have an agenda of their own, and they don't give a shit about what you think about it. They want to implement it. When they present the idea of the Great Reset, how they're going to create a new, basically something similar to the Industrial Revolution on that scale in society, change society completely, they have that vision. They want to implement it, but they never, nowhere in there do they say, let's have a vote in every country. A yes or no, are we going to implement the Great Reset or not? No, because they don't give a shit about what you get to vote about irrelevant stuff. You don't get to vote about the big issues, right? I think that is the great thing about the Great Reset, that it gives us an example. Because let me give you another example, the Bilderberg meeting. Now, the Bilderberg meeting is very, very similar to the World Economic Forum.
Davos,
yeah. The interesting thing about the Bilderberg meeting is that for decades, the mainstream media said that it was just a conspiracy theory, that it doesn't exist. It's just a figment of the imagination of conspiracy theorists. But starting, I think, less than 10 years ago, the mass media is just writing about the Bilderberg meeting in the exact same way as they're writing about Davos. That is, they have gone from saying, no, it doesn't exist, to saying, well, yeah, it's always existed. Of course it exists. This is just a top meeting for elite people in the financial elite and the media and the political elite. Of course, it's a natural thing. But the point is that if you believe that the world works according to the principles of democracy, where everyone has the same influence and that our political elites or social elites care about what we think, you're mistaken. And this is just a very good way of showing people that, yeah, there these elites exist. They have a different lifestyle than you and me. Therefore, they have a different vision of a utopia than you and me. And furthermore, they want to implement their utopia, and they don't give a shit if you object. They don't say, yeah, we want to implement this if more than 50% of the population agrees. No, they don't give a shit about what the people think. So, I mean, it's in that sense, we still have this sort of religious faith in that we live in a democracy. Not really. I mean, because when it doesn't fit their agenda, they don't let us vote about it.
Yeah. And if a party comes up that doesn't fit their agenda, then they use their media to attack that party and make sure that it's demonized.
Yeah.
And that no one will vote for it.
Yeah.
So, and the parties that they will talk about favorably in their media are the ones who are irrelevant, the ones who are innocuous. Mm-hmm. It will not change anything.
Yeah.
So again, democracy is controlled by those in power. It's just another way for them to control the masses. But with this weird lie that the masses have independence, that the masses have agency. It's like you're complimenting. It's like when you say to someone, "I think you have tremendous judgment. Therefore, you'll do what I advise." Obviously,
yeah.
You have tremendous judgment. It's flattering them to make them do what you want.
It is that definitely a manipulative trick, but it's also shifting the blame. And this is something that I've talked about a lot in the past with mass immigration. That when you ask people, why do we have mass immigration all over the West, you'll hear people say that, well, we have democracy. So it's basically, well, it's your fault. Everyone's. It's your fault that we have mass. No, it isn't, because you're not allowed to object, right? And the elites will crush every political party that wants to say no. So, I mean, it is a false. It creates a false perception of how politics and social development works, because they will shift the blame by saying that you voted for this, when in reality you were never really given a choice. But it's a way for them to say that no, we didn't create this. We didn't create mass immigration. We didn't create. No, I mean, you could have just voted for another party then, who would have done something different if you didn't want this. So, I mean, it's a way of shifting the blame. It's a way of blaming the victim, really. So yes. It's a very sinister in that way. There's a lot of just dishonesty going on.
It's diabolically clever.
Yeah.
It's, as you say, it's gaslighting. Somebody used the term gaslighting, and it is. It's persuading you that you're the one responsible.
They're saying that it doesn't. You still hear that mass immigration doesn't exist. the replacement thing. Oh, that's a conspiracy theory. Is it a conspiracy theory? I mean, if you go out and most of the people you see are not from the actual people from that country, is that a figment of my imagination? It's gaslighting.
Yes, they come up with ridiculous ways to maintain the claim that it's a conspiracy theory. And what they'll say is, yes, it's happening, but it's not deliberate. or yes, you are being replaced, but it's not a conscious plan to replace you. It's just change. It's just natural change.
Yeah.
But no, the end result will be exactly the same. But you're wrong to think that it's a conspiracy against you.
Yeah. They come up with all kinds of sophistical things, but at the end of the day, this is not our desire, and we never had a chance or an opportunity to vote no. And it's the exact same thing with the Great Reset. It's not like they're going to let us vote on it. It's like Mark Twain said, if voting mattered, they wouldn't let us do it. So, I mean, is the Great Reset in that sense is just a good example of I think, how a very important political change happens. It's because the people in power find it desirable, and they will implement it no matter what you say.
Yeah.
They will at least try.
They will. I mean, nobody, and as you say, I'm trying to work out how this will play out, because I can imagine saying to someone 5 years from now, well, did the Great Reset happened and you didn't get any say in it. None of us did. It was just done. And I can imagine a normie NPC saying, But what was the Great Reset? It was just a set of economic policies that it hasn't really changed anything. It's not important. That's why we didn't get a vote on it, because it wasn't important. These things were going to happen anyway. It's just change, just natural evolution. Because then you have to get into the details and say, well, no, it does matter. It is important. This is an economic policy. That this is an entire new way of living, of conceiving of the world, of capitalism, of commerce, interaction. But it really should. It should be something that's discussed. And if you believe in democracy, then it's something that should definitely be put to the vote. But it's something that won't be, because for reasons that we have already gone into. But they'll say, well, it's not the kind of thing that people vote on. So, of course, it wouldn't go to the vote. it's really quite incredible, because it's possible for them to make very profound changes to our society, but claim that it's not something that's worth voting on. Yeah. Meantime, the stuff that is worth voting on is bullshit. It's meaningless rubbish. Like, whether this set of puppets get into power or this set of puppets get into power, the power that they're vying over is meaningless.
For example, Sweden has had a couple of referenda through its history. Like, one of them is, which side of the road are we going to drive on? But we didn't have a vote on mass immigration. Do you want to be an ethnic minority in your country? Now, that's not important.
Yeah.
That's a trivial issue.
That's just natural change. It was always going to happen. Come on.
Yeah.
How can you stop mass immigration?
Insane.
So somebody's just donated a diamond and said, you failed to object sufficiently, Bolshevik. So it's a quote from a Bolshevik. You failed to object sufficiently. And that is after the fact. That'll be what they say. If it's raised at all, it'll be, well, you if you really didn't want this, you should have complained about it harder. Even though we were basically threatening to wreck your life, to destroy your life if you did object to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's when society is run by fanatics, they'll not be very eager to hear any objections at all. They'll just, because they think, again, I mean, they don't think that they're doing anything evil. They think that they're creating a utopia. They think that they're going to be remembered as great people, you know, and they're fanatics. They're like religious fanatics. They're like jihadis, basically. They're globalist jihadis. They don't care how many people die or how many people's lives are destroyed in the process, their utopia shall be created, no matter what.
And you can see this right now with the lockdowns, because that has wrecked God knows how many businesses, how many livelihoods, how many people and employees are now fired from businesses that have gone bankrupt. We cannot even begin, at this point, we can't begin to count the cost of the lockdowns in all of these different countries. But I think it's going to be devastating for generations. I think it's something that we have lived through something in this year that will cast a shadow over the majority of this century, I think.
I mean, you and I are you know, we're not young anymore. Sorry to break it to you, we're not young anymore. Imagine having the year that you're 19 years old being in prison, essentially. Because you have to just stay indoors. You're not allowed to do anything. Imagine all the young people. Imagine if you're 10 years old. Time is a lot slower when you're a child, you know, because you're supposed to develop. You have to develop in a social environment, a context, right? But if you're just locked up like this and if you just you're treated like a prisoner. You're treated like a criminal, and you're treated like a suspect. You know, you have to wash your hands. You have to put on the mask. You have to do this and that. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. I mean, imagine being like 15, and you know, you want to spread your wings, learn about things, and so on, and you just can't do it because you've got to stay indoors. I mean, for teenagers, this year must have been horrendous, and for the kids as well, because. Even at a more fundamental level, they should be learning about socializing. And I mean, fuck, you know, I can't imagine. And I've said it before, that for these kids learning, who are being trained with social distancing at the age of like 4 or 5, It's just horrendous. I can't imagine the psychological effects that that's going to have on them socially and so on.
It's because the people leading our society, they don't have empathy. You'll obviously create mental damage on people who have to live like that. It's the same thing with, you know, just confusing kids about, you know, gender issues or whatnot in their entire upbringing. These people will end up with, you know, personality disorders, many of them. I mean, there's no telling the long-term effects that this will have on a lot of people.
We weren't doing well in that regard already with the abundance of personality disorders nowadays, just because of the way we were already living, the neoliberalism. I think that has definitely had, there's a reason why there are so many nutty people around these days. But the COVID stuff, the lockdown is going to, it'll be horrendous.
It's Christmas Eve, right? A lot of people are depressed and people even commit more suicide on Christmas than on other days because they become even more conscious of how lonely they are, right? And this is a real thing. This isn't a joke. I have a friend who right now is in quarantine. He was going to go home to his family over Christmas, but he's not allowed to travel because he had to go to the hospital, and because he's been at the hospital and there are some sick people at the hospital, he doesn't have COVID. Just as a precaution, he has to stay at home. So he's not he has to sit completely alone in an apartment on Christmas. This is abuse. It just is. It's not justified in any way. The virus, I don't like people who say that the virus doesn't exist because it's ridiculous. I mean, we all know people who've probably had it, but it's not justified. The measures that they have taken are not justified by how dangerous the virus actually is.
Oh yeah. I'm willing to believe that the virus exists. I wouldn't deny it, but you're absolutely right that, it is abuse. You know, you might have seen footage. People have been filming with their mobile phones, things happening like at old people, like care homes, old folks homes, it's just so bad. You know, it really is abuse. It's cruelty. It's sadistic. I visited a relative in a care home when I went home, and I had to keep the mask on 2 meters away. And I couldn't touch her, couldn't cuddle her, anything. And that was for, I don't think she knew who I was.
Yeah, I had a relative die in the beginning of the COVID thing. We weren't allowed to visit him in the hospital. You don't want relatives to die alone. People you loved and known all your life, and they've worked a whole life, worked hard, and been empathetic people, and then in the final days of their lives, just put them in a room somewhere and just let them die alone. It's inhumane. It's completely. It's sociopathic. And that's what I mean with these fanatics. The people doing this are ideological fanatics. They think they're going to save the world no matter what the cost, and they don't care how many people die or how many lives are ruined, because they think that they're creating they're going to save everything. So
I'm not sure what to say about this, what can be said. But I do wonder how many people could be arrested, you know, if there was mass disobedience of these rules. I do wonder what could the justice system, the judicial system, actually, and the police, indeed, what could they actually sustain in terms of arresting a whole population and so on. I wonder if we'll get to that point.
So there are two factors, right? We saw a brilliant example with the BLM riots in London. The first weekend, there were BLM riots. The police were running scared out of there. They weren't even equipped for a riot. But when the bad people were demonstrating the very weekend after, 1 week after, they were equipped with riot gear and they were busting heads, right? They were smashing heads open. and so, you know, when there's something that they, that according to their narrative is bad, they have a lot more resources and a lot more willpower to deal with the issue than they have in other cases. Let's just say that. The other factor is that we have become so passive as a people. I don't know if people in the West have it in them anymore to be socially or civil, you know, to do this sort of civil disobedience strategy and actually take a beating for something they believe in. A lot of we have become more passive. I mean, okay, I'll just give you one example. I was watching this film. So we've done a lot of sort of talked about a lot of Christmas films on Guide to Culture. And so one of the films we talked about was A Christmas Story from 1983. So this film is made in 1983. And one thing that I thought about when I saw it is that, okay, this is, there isn't a computer in the film, no internet, no smartphones, you know. And I was just thinking about the difference in these few decades of how distracted we are by such things. And I was thinking about if you locked people up for a year in 1983 when that film was set, compared to now, the point is that if we didn't have the internet to distract us and to have like interactions like this, would we have accepted a lockdown for a year? We couldn't have lived like that. It wouldn't have been possible. You couldn't have kept people inside. But the sad fact of the matter is that I think a lot of people's lives, a lot of people were actually joking about this, that a lot of people's lives haven't changed all that much from before the lockdown until, you know, if you know what I mean, because they were already just sitting inside, spending most of their time online. And
yeah, yeah.
The thing is that I think our lifestyle over the last few decades has made us more passive in many ways.
Yeah, well, the other thing is that the media have just become so much more adept at getting a message across. This was what you were saying earlier about just now about how the virus is it can be used in different ways. You said something, and I can't remember what it was, but it reminded me of this post that I wrote on Telegram. I don't know when this was, November, the 8th of November. I'm going to read this out. For the powers that be, the COVID virus plus lockdown, problem plus solution, is the perfect tool to use against the public. It can be invoked, threatened, implemented, revised, expanded, revoked, reintroduced. Sometimes the analyses of the virus will make sense, but they don't need to make sense. Sometimes the uses of the lockdown will make sense, but they don't need to make sense. It is all entirely at the whim of the government, because the media will ratify whatever decisions the government makes as perfectly justified and proportionate and completely in line with established precedent, even though there are so many contradictions along the way that there is no established precedent. A BLM rally without masks is safe, because bullshit. A Remembrance Day parade with masks is unsafe, because bullshit. You think this doesn't make sense? Well, you just don't understand the science. The virus is endlessly malleable as a problem, the lockdown endlessly malleable as a solution. Never have so many been so controlled so easily.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think there are a lot of factors, but I think that, you know, we are, like someone said in the comments, we are completely different people now. I mean, we are a different people now. I mean, we can lament and we don't have to lament. I don't think we should, but I think we should just be aware of it. That old models for politics, old models for change are becoming obsolete because people who have been isolated like this, they will not go out. And that's also a part of it. I mean, if you have people together in a group, it gives them courage. When you have them isolated one and one, they lose a lot of courage. And I think that also makes it less likely that there will be any major civil disobedience. And they tried. They've tried to have huge protests in Germany. They were beaten down hard, those protests, you know. And, yeah, like I said, our elites, the people in power, they claim that they don't have resources to deal with the actual problems in society. But when someone actually goes out and protests against how they exercise power, then they have endless resources to attack them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was seen very starkly in Britain this year, and I'm sure in other countries as well. It's quite incredible. Suddenly there is efficiency, logistics, resources, manpower. It's just there.
You remember the headline in BBC, right? The mostly peaceful protest with 27 police officers injured?
Yes.
Would they have said the same thing if the other people had rioted and 27 police officers were injured? No. They would have said this is a war zone and we need to send in the military.
Yes. Incredible. And that did enter the sort of lore of opposition to the mainstream media. That expression, mostly peaceful protest, because it was just such a surreal example of manipulation right in front of you there. And that does remind me of a Telegram group that I joined this year, a Telegram channel called Media Tricks, which is fantastic. And I would recommend that everybody has a look at that. It was invaluable during the US election, for example. I'll just link it in the live chat here. Media Tricks, very good one. So, okay, I think we've probably gone through that topic now. I don't want to end this on a pessimistic note, because this is, you know, Christmas Eve and it's Christmas Day for you, effectively. So I don't want people to get too depressed. But let's go through some questions first, and people can post more questions on Entropy or on DLive as well. Somebody just donated a diamond and said, do you need a 1776? we definitely need something to restore the I think that there does need to be some kind of dissidence, some kind of rebellion. Yes, I would say that. And as for revolution or whatever, or violence, I wouldn't say that. Okay. So Forrest Magus here, he says, Merry Christmas, Frodian Woes. Thank you very much.
And Merry Christmas.
He also goes by Byzantium Sailor, and I know him well. He used to follow me on Twitter back in the day. Someone says, conservatives and frankly most right-wingers cannot intellectually comprehend that some people in the world have ambitions beyond money. Hence their autistic let the market decide solutions, which fail. And yeah, you're absolutely right. This is about the lack of imagination among a lot of right-wingers. Who especially a certain generation of that I won't name, but they do seem to think that everything is about money and everything is about market forces, and that's all that really matters, and you can basically trust the market and the invisible hand of the market. This relates to what Frodi was saying earlier about people don't understand that at a certain level, billionaires are no longer seeking more money. They're seeking ways to use their money to change the world.
Yeah, that's a part of liberalism as well. I mean, the liberal worldview is that we sort of maximize benefits as a utilitarian mindset, that we're going to do rational things to maximize wealth. And, you know, everyone acts that people don't. That's not how people work. I mean, some people have. They don't care about money, probably everyone cares somewhat about money, but they care more about other things than money and comfort. Some people are ideological fanatics, and they have a vision of how they want to change society, and they're going to, you know, give their life or take lives in order to do it. And you know, a lot of the bad guys are they have no qualms about taking lives to change society their way, and that's just a fact. It's a sad fact. They'll downplay. So, a guy in Sweden, a 19-year-old guy, was murdered when he tried to prevent a girl from being raped. Swedish mass media basically slandered him or tried to downplay. They tried to trivialize what happened because it didn't fit their narrative. I mean, the thing is, life, these things don't matter to them. Their narrative, their ideology does matter. As with regard to the question, yeah, conservatives, they lack a vision. They are just afraid of the change that everyone else, that the left is creating, right? They don't have a vision of their own. They just want to go back. They want to go back to how things were before, but that is impossible, right? So we have to have a vision of what we want to create, not just be reactive. The leftists used to have a word that was reactionary. They used to use that word. They don't use it so much anymore, but it's a very true description of the mainstream right, that they're reactionary. They don't have a vision of their own. They just react to what the other side does all the time, and that's not enough. You have to play your own game. Otherwise, you're going to lose.
Yes, demonstrably. The mainstream right has lost consistently for 100 years, or if not more. Okay, somebody says that whiteness is a social construct. Sam Harris, et cetera, told me so. Yes, indeed, Baku Media. Yes, point taken. And then someone says, Peter... I'm not going to read out people's names just in case they don't want that. I just want to say Merry Christmas, brother, and I'm grateful that you're back. You're very good at interviewing guests. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much. That's appreciated. And somebody asks, what does Frodi's chest tattoo say, and where did he get it done?
Well,
is this safe for YouTube?
If it's a woman asking that, I assume I'm going to say there's only one way to find out. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm not going to reveal what it says. I got it done in Sweden many years ago. I haven't gotten a new tattoo in many, many years. I guess I'm just too old to get new tattoos. No, it's an old tattoo. I'm not going to reveal what it says. It has religious significance. It's very important to me.
Okay. Okay, Joe the Walloon says, Skoil, and he donates a diamond, so thank you for that. Angerad Celtic says, it's not Yule without an excellent conversation between Wozie and Frodi. Good Yule. Thank you very much, Angerad. Someone else says, make white babies. That's very nice. I agree. And someone else says, and donates a diamond, and someone else donated a diamond and said, emotional manipulation brought on by feminism. I don't know what we were discussing at that point, but I think it might have been to do with the media being using people's fear of danger against them. And then also Dan Zucker donated 50 euros, so thank you very much for that, Dan. Okay. And what else? Ah, yes, another question. We need to push the difference. This is when we're talking about how the elites go to university and meet people of different cultures and so on. Yeah. Someone says, we need to push the difference between the macro and the micro. The micro is one person, e.g. Imran Khan, the Oxford-educated, urbane, Pakistani cricketer. The macro is rape gangs and Islamization. Big difference. Yes, indeed.
I agree. I mean, yeah, the whole point and why even the premises of liberalism are wrong to begin with is because liberalism is about individuals, but society isn't about individuals. Society is about how huge groups of people work together.
Did you disappear? Yeah. Don't worry. It's just a technical thing. Okay. And then, yes, of course, you have to consider, and this is something that I think we have fallen out of this habit of seeing things in group terms over the last century. And I think it's crazy because everyone else still does see things in group terms. So I think we should really not be embarrassed or ashamed of doing that. I mean, we know that obviously in the movement, but I think
it's just, It's just a political fallacy that comes with liberalism, that we are individuals. And if this and this individual can live in society together, then a million versions of this and a million versions of this individual can live in society together. No, because then they'll create groups. That's the point. That's how society works. I mean, that's, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. I should have said that Angerad Celtic donated a Ninja Guinea, so that's now my second Ninja Guinea. So I, this has been a very profitable stream for me so far, so thank you very much. All right, and then high IQ takes here, gents. In my experience, people are moving towards race realism. The difference from 15 to 20 years ago is vast. The BLM riots and fake news about them contributed to this. Cheers and Merry Christmas. Well, thank you very much. I wouldn't be surprised if people are realizing certain things at this point. It gets ever more obvious.
Let me just say, just very briefly that, you know, yeah, that is a true observation. I mean, people often look very short term and think that all things have gone down in the last year or up in the last year. If you look at a couple of decades, the right wing was completely irrelevant a couple of decades ago. But now just look at the reach we have and how the quality of the content we produce. I mean, it's a different world.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. People want leadership today. Look at the US election. Look at the dependency on the media. The office of dictator was created by the Roman Republic. But what does that mean in the modern world? I'm not really sure what he's asking there. I guess he's asking people want leadership. So, you know, it's dangerous territory to be on. I think that we will see how things develop. And I do agree that people want leadership and hierarchy. I don't think that people are nearly as attached to democracy as they say they are. I think what people are attached to is stability. What they want is stability and prosperity, comfort for sure, and a sense of what they should do in life, how to get by in life, how to live a good life. I think that's what people really want. As for their views being taken seriously by those in charge, in times of extreme hardship, yes, of course, people want their leaders to take them seriously and want their leaders to listen to them. But I think from day to day, I don't think people are really bothered about having a political... I mean, you can just see how apolitical most people are, how disengaged in the political process most people are. So I don't think that democracy in itself is something that's very dear to people. But I do think that people rationally, sanely, want to know that they are taken seriously by those in power. The big irony here is that we live in an age of democracy, and yet it's very clear, as we were saying earlier, that ordinary people are not taken seriously by those in power. Those in power have basic contempt or loathing for ordinary people. It's the opposite of what it should be. You know, the public are on the one hand despised, and but at the same time denied legitimacy and not taken seriously, but at the same time are told, are convinced that yes, you're taken seriously. Look, you've got a vote. It's really a very clever game that's been played on them.
Yeah, I don't think politics is the solution. I think we have a spiritual crisis in our civilization. I think people have lost a sense of meaning in anything at all, and they have lost their sense of direction. I'm not going to go in too much on that topic, but I think I don't really think that, you know, political organizations are going to solve that essential problems. That doesn't mean that I don't think political organizations should that I don't think they should exist. I just think that we have a very profound problem, probably more profound than a lot of people realize.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is not something that's simple or straightforward or obvious. The problem is spiritual. I do believe that this is how we got into this situation in the first place. It's because we were already unhealthy at a deeper level, a more subtle level, and that's how we've been able to get to this this situation where it all becomes much more real. Well, I guess we should. One more. Hello, mate. Just a cheeky Merry Christmas before I go away to my bed. All the best to Frody and yourself. Well, thank you very much. Send some communum, and Merry Christmas to you too. Let's wrap this one up. In keeping with what we were saying earlier, I'll say that unlike the elites, I do need more money rather than power. So if you would like to donate, please feel free to do that. And the ways to do that are there in the live chat now. That would be very nice. Someone said to me I should be more proactive about, you know, saying to people that they can donate. So there we go. I'm not Bill Gates and I do need more resources. So if you're enjoying Millennial, please help to support me.
Support millennials. What you want to say?
Oh, well, I was just going to ask if you had any warm words to end this episode with, given that it is Christmas time and Yule time.
It is Christmas time. We've had so much to talk about. I was going to say something about the history of Christmas and everything, but I'm going to do that in another time because I know that you have other live streams coming up as well. But this has been great. I always enjoy Millennial. It's like I said before you started this Millennial this year, I said that this is one of the few traditions that we're actually going to be able to participate in this year because it's been so odd. But yeah, I've enjoyed it. If people want to see more of my work, I've done two special episodes on Christmas films. So if you go to Guide to Culture, guidetoculture.org, and you can probably find the links here as well, the two last episodes are about Christmas films. So if you want to see discussions, more philosophical discussions about that, you can do that. We did one episode with Edmund Connolly, who writes for the Occidental Observer, Kevin MacDonald's site, on the war against Christmas in the movies. That's actually a great episode. And then we did a Christmas special, me, Ty E, and Greg Johnson. We did a special about Fanny and Alexander and A Christmas Story. And if people want to see the most iconic Christmas ever, to get in the mood, they should watch Ingmar Bergman's film Fanny and Alexander from 1982. It's the most beautiful Christmas celebration in film history. So that is, I guess, an upbeat way of ending this, to recommend that people should watch that to get in the right mood. But thank you so much for watching, and definitely support the continuation of Millennial. So thank you so much for having me.
Excellent. You're very welcome, Frody. I'll just mention, because there are some DLive gifts that I should have mentioned. A Ninja Guinea from Drywall Bear, and he says, Merry Christmas. A Diamond from Skags. A Diamond and a Ninja Guinea from Silosopher. Merry Christmas, he says, with a little Christmas tree next to it. That's very touching. Varangian donates a diamond and says, thanks as always. And that's them all. So, and then quite a few ice creams and lemons, which I'm just learning about this stuff. So, forgive me if I don't understand what it all means, but thank you very much. So, okay, excellent. Well, I will be back in about 10 minutes with Charlemagne. In the meantime, Frody Midyard, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2020.
Thank you so much.
Excellent. See you all at Merry Christmas, and I'll see you all in about 10 minutes. Bye for now.